Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our daily broadcast. Today's quote is about Hattaka. Hattaka is one of these important lay disciples. Lay meaning not ordained. So, householder, disciples of the Buddha. It's about seven qualities that Hattaka is said to have possessed. It's typical of the Buddha's teaching. This is a teaching from the Anguttara Nikaya. We've got so many lists, it's hard to keep track of them all. See, we have to remember that the teachings of the Buddha were not written as a book. They weren't taught from the point of view of composing a single work that was meant to be read from beginning to end. But these were actually actual talks that the Buddha gave at different times to different audiences. And so there's a lot of repetition because for the most part we all need to hear the same thing. But on the other hand, each of us has our own individual inclinations and that our problems are unique in their intensity or in their their importance to each of us. For some people, anger is the predominant obstacle. For some people, greed is the predominant obstacle. Different people have different character types as well. So some people are intellectual, others are passionate, and so on. We have to adjust the teaching. But these seven qualities are the, I think they're the seven treasures. You can't keep track of them all. But these seven are taught elsewhere, and they should be familiar from some of the other lists that we've had. But it's a really, this is a this is an important list, or a really, really good list for us to remember. It's one of those lists that we can use as an outline for how to live our lives. And you won't find a lot of answers in regards to how to live your life in terms of actions or decisions. Should I do this? Should I do that? What's a proper livelihood? And so on. There's beyond the basic moral ethical precepts, there's a lot of leeway, and there's not a great deal of instruction on making decisions as far as do this, don't do that. But there's much more of an emphasis on qualities of mind. It's because unless you know the exact details of your actions, you can't always know the consequences. We've talked about this before, that something may look like a good deed, but the consequences might just happen to set you on a bad path. You might try to do something good, and because of the circumstances, it just makes you upset and confused and causes you to decline in wholesomeness. On the other hand, you might be trying to do something terrible, and in the act of doing it, you get caught, or you get you feel some remorse and find that this act actually turns out to be the best thing that could have happened to you. Right? So it's very, very complicated. What is a good deed? What is a bad deed? The only way we can truly understand good karma, bad karma, and really make sense of this comprehensive or systematic way is to focus on qualities of mind. And these are momentary. These are now. So these are seven qualities, and this is what the Buddha would focus on, qualities of mind. If your mind is pure, you don't have to worry about your actions. Your actions are secondary to the state of mind, because you can't be sure what the consequences are going to be, what the results are going to be of your actions. But you can, what you can be in charge of or on top of is your reactions, your interactions with the events as they unfold. So what are the qualities of mind we should have to be able to react appropriately? Faith, virtue, self-respect, fear of blame, learning, generosity, and wisdom. Really, self-respect. It's a very strange translation. Shouldn't be self-respect. Let's go to Bhikkhu Bodhi. He's our go-to guy as far as translations. Moral shame and moral dread is how Bhikkhu Bodhi translates. So let's start at the beginning. Virtuous silava, someone who is moral and ethical. This is a basis. In Buddhism, it's not meditation is not the basis. Morality is the basis. And it's important, as with all things, morality is at its essence based in the mind. It's based on our intentions. It's not actually at its essence based on our actions. Morality is the mental volition or the work that we do to keep the mind from wandering, keep the mind from being distracted. The work that we do to bring the mind back to the present moment is actually the best, most essential way of understanding morality. Meditation, in fact, is at its essence the act of morality, the act of ethical behavior in its ultimate form. Because when the opportunity comes to be upset, to like or dislike, or become arrogant or conceited, it's the mind that prevents that. It's the mindfulness, it's the act of meditation. So all this effort that we do not to kill, not to steal, all of that is simply the sort of the coarse manifestation of the essential quality of to some extent controlling the mind, to the extent that there is any control. And it's important because there's not a lot of control. You can't stop yourself from wanting things. You can't stop yourself from thinking. You can't stop experiences from coming. You can't control in that sense. But there is a sense that the mind can be controlled through effort, through applied and sustained practice. The mind is able to not only not react to experiences, but not react to our reactions. So when we do get angry, to be able to see the anger clearly. When we do want something, to be able to see the greed clearly, the desire clearly, and let it go. So in meditation we are practicing morality, we are practicing ethics. You might think, well, What does ethics have to do with sitting still? When you're sitting still, there's no opportunity to kill or steal. No, morality is much more fundamental, much more basic than that. It's called virati, citta-sika, the mind that abstains. The mind is just no. So when your mind is not falling for the trap of getting caught up in thoughts or emotions, reactions, that's morality. And it's morality because it leads to concentration, it leads to focus. The mind becomes focused when you do this. That's how you know it's true morality. But in a general sense, this coarse and sort of mundane morality, it's in the same vein, and it's still important. It's important not to kill and not to steal, because these are sort of fence posts to help you gauge where the mindfulness, where a mindful mind will stop. If your mind is mindful, mindfulness is like the fence. Precepts are like the fence post. So without the fence post, it's very hard to know where the fence should go. It's very hard to get a sense of right and wrong. But it's only when you put up the mindfulness that you actually are able to be moral and ethical. Precepts don't do that. They're important, but they're only fence posts. In and of themselves, they don't keep the mind in. This requires mindfulness. Silava, and then hirima otapa, otapi. Hirima means has hiri, otapi means has otapa. Hiri and otapa always go together. And they're explained as they're explained as fear and shame, which makes them sound actually somewhat unwholesome, right? These are called, fear and shame are bad things. They're a cause for suffering, but these mind states are only technically fear and shame. They're actually, they're not fear and they're not shame at all. These two words are not actually appropriate, but that's the words that the Buddha used to describe them. But they're the inclination or the disinclination towards unwholesome deeds, which really comes through wisdom or comes from whatever, but the disinclination to do evil deeds. When the mind is aware or observes an unwholesome intention as a cause for suffering, and one sees the problem with the state, and one understands the negative result, this is fear and shame. Fear is referring to the result. You think of the result and you think the result of doing that is not good. But it's not fear, it's just you know that it's bad. If you know something is bad, you would never do it. You really understood. The reason we give rise to unwholesomeness is we really don't understand them as bad. And shame is referring to the deed itself. When you look at the mind state or the direction that your mind is going in, and you think that's bad. I mean, they're really related. You know, it's actually, why is it bad? Because of the result. But it's when you focus on the deed or the state of mind, and you say, oh, that's not good. That's called shame. And so it's the good part of shame and the good part of fear. They aren't really shame and fear, but that's how they're described. It just means a disinclination towards deeds and towards certain results. When you don't want to suffer, when you are clear in your mind, not that you're afraid of suffering or something, but when you're clear in your mind that that's not a good thing, you know, that's not of any use or any benefit, it's trouble. When the mind is disinclined due to the troublesome nature or because of the the complicated nature of the state, that's otapa, or that's which one is which. Here he is shame, that's all different. After that we have Bahusutta. Bahusutta we talked about yesterday. It was in the list yesterday, I think. Bahusutto means having much learning, being learned. This is a common one in these lists. So anyone who thinks that you can just practice meditation and you shouldn't ever study isn't following the Buddha's advice. It's true, at times the Buddha has said you don't need to do much study, but he's very much in praise of those who do, because study is important not only for yourself but for others as well. Yesterday we had talk about teaching, right? How great it is for a person to actually teach others. So the teachings won't be passed on if there are not people who have studied, who have learned much more than is perhaps necessary for themselves. So someone who memorizes all these lists may not be able to use all of them for their own benefit, and may not need them all for their own benefit, but is then able to apply them to different people in different circumstances, looking at why the Buddha taught or when the Buddha taught different teachings, they can then apply them for other people. So that's Bahusutto. Chagawa means has chaga. Chaga means donation, generosity. Someone is generous. Really happy. Did I miss one? Sadda. Oh, I missed Sadda. I missed the first one. The first one, of course, is Sadda. Saddho. One has faith in the Buddha. One has confidence. We've talked about faith many times. Sadda. Sadda is important. It's important to have some kind of faith in what you do. Of course, the best kind of faith is through wisdom. But it can also be through observation and through rational thought. That's a good way in the beginning to sort of get faith, is to sort of analyze things and to see. But we should, once we've analyzed, we should not get stuck on this idea, this state of this state of doubt. State of skepticism. Once you've analyzed, you should pick something to have faith in. You should have confidence in those things that you've studied, because otherwise you'll doubt things irrationally. And this happens. We doubt things for no reason. Some people are too enamored with their doubt that they think that doubt is always good. If I doubt it, it's a sign. Or it's important to always doubt. No, it's not actually good to doubt. It's possible to doubt things even after you've gone through it completely and affirm for yourself that it's perfect, it's right, it's good. You can still doubt it. You can still say, is it really good? Because we're ignorant. We don't really understand. We don't have wisdom. Once you have wisdom, it's not possible to doubt. Doubt won't arise. Because you know. Anyway, that's saddha, very important in the beginning. It's sort of a preliminary for the practice. If you don't have confidence, you won't put your heart into what you do. So, anyway, back to the end of our list. Number six is chaga. Chaga, be generous. This is usually taught to lay people. It's not so common for monks to get this teaching on being generous, because in a mundane sense it's very much to do with giving charity to poor people, giving charity to religious people. But this is an important part of our spiritual life as lay people, of people's spiritual life as lay people, because they have things, they have possessions. And without generosity, the inclination is to cling, is to accumulate, is to identify with, this is me, this is mine. We become very caught up and trapped by our possessions. And so giving them, giving away possessions, giving away resources is a very important part of our spiritual practice. Not very important, I mean it's not essential, but it's it has importance because of that, for that reason, that we're so, not monks, but as lay people who live their lives surrounded by money and possessions, it's very easy to become intoxicated by them. So giving them away helps to counter that. You'll find there's the tension, I want this, I don't want to give it away. And having to give it away is a useful, helpful practice. And number seven, panyava. Panyava is wise, is filled with wisdom, full of wisdom. Lay people, wisdom is not just an exclusive monastic thing, and this was perhaps somewhat unique, and it has been somewhat unique in religion, where the non-ordained individuals are supposed to be wise as well. Yeah, it's not that unique nowadays. Nowadays, there's not a sense that priests are any better than lay people. Even in Buddhism, there's a lot less of a esteem for monks than there used to be. So a lot of lay people are going on their own and studying on their own, which has mixed results. Sometimes leads to some fairly crazy opinions. Because the thing about being a monk is you've got a fairly stable life and a fairly ordinary life. There's not as much, generally speaking, going on in the mind to distort the teachings. But if you're living your life as a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, you'll have your own bent, your own take on the teachings. That is often somewhat radical, can be radical. Of course, monks have lots of crazy ideas as well. It's not to say that it's only a lay thing, but at any rate, it certainly is proper for lay people to be teachers, to be leaders, to be preachers of truth. In Buddhism, there is no sense that only monks have the monopoly on wisdom, certainly not on teaching. But of course, even wisdom is not something that you need to ordain to obtain. Ordinary, everyday folk can become enlightened. Hataka was an anagami. He was a layperson. He lived his life as a rich man. I think he was rich. But at any rate, he was pure. He was an anagami. No greed, no anger, only a little bit of delusion left, or ignorance. Still wasn't fully clear in his mind. There's a cute thing that happens in this sutta, which is probably why he chose this quote. They go and tell Hataka, the monks hear this, the Buddha's praising this layman. And the monks go and tell this Hataka. And what does he say? He says, I hope there were no lay people present. His first thought is that the Buddha might be other people might hear the Buddha praising him, and that would affect them, that it would pump him up in their eyes. It's cute, I think, because it's just being humble. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong if people esteem you, but it's sort of this clarity of mind in his mind that. To be clear where he stands, in case people think that he is, in case people accuse him of being ingratiating himself with the Buddha, or accuse him of being puffed up because of the Buddha. It's funny how we do this. No, we hear someone saying good about someone else, and we immediately try to take the other person down. It's that kind of thing, I think. And his reply is to ward that off, so that people might not give rise to unwholesome thoughts, thinking that he is somehow puffed up, or full of himself, thinking that he is great. I am this great lay disciple. So he says, I hope nobody heard. I hope none of my friends heard him praising me. Anyway, so that's the seven. Oh, and then, right, okay, sorry, there's more. And so then they go and tell the Buddha this. And this is one monk, actually. He goes and tells the Buddha that what Hattaka said, and the Buddha said, Hattaka has an eighth quality that I didn't mention, and that's modesty. And this is an eighth wonderful quality of him. Sadhu, sadhu, bhikkhu, apicho. Apicho means a fewness of wishes. Icha means desires. Appa, api, up. I say up, I guess. Up. Appa means few or little. Little desire. So he's clear that he has no desire to be some big shot. No desire for people to think of him as some great person. Like Sariputta said, if you imagine a young man or woman decked up in finery and all beautied up, and then someone were to hang a dog, a dead dog or a dead cat or a dead chicken around their neck, how do you think they'd feel about that chicken or that dead dog? And the monk said, oh, I'm not very good. And so Buddha said, well, that's how I look at this body. That's how I look at myself. I think of myself as this burden that I have to carry around. That's all quite disgusting, actually. You get a sense of how an enlightened being looks at the world. I mean, I suppose that's not very impressive to most people, but for us as meditators, I think it's quite impressive. And worthy of respect, because it's amazing how free that person then is, you know, to not be concerned about the body, thinking, oh, this body, may it stay beautiful, may it stay wonderful, may it stay powerful. I think this body, it's getting old, sick, it's going to die. That's more in line with the truth, right? And if you free yourself from that, then you don't. Then there's no potential for suffering. Anyway, so that's the Dhamma for tonight. If anyone has questions, I believe there are some leftover questions, interim questions, so I'll answer some of them. I did invite Robin to the hangout tonight. I thought maybe she might like to come on, help me in the hangout. But oh, she's here. Oh. Again, my audio. This looks, something's wrong with the audio drivers here, I guess. We're moving this week. At the end of this week, we'll start to move to our new house. I believe Robin's coming up to join in it. Why is my audio all mixed up? I think it's fixed now. Nope. usually it clears up, but it's not clearing up. Something's wrong with this. This is the wonder of Linux. It's a great, such a great operating system, but when it doesn't work, it just doesn't work. Let me see here. Playback. I don't know what I'm doing. Still there? Oh, did I know how to... Was there a way to do it in ALSA? No, that didn't work. That didn't help. All right, well, I'm going to have to, is it fixed now? Hello?
Hi.
Oh.
Is that any better?
It's much better.
Oh, good.
See, it usually just clears up. Suddenly it's good all of a sudden. All right. Okay, you want to be my question person?
I'm sorry.
Now we've got an echo problem. I'm echoing on your speakers, I think. I think you need a headset.
Okay.
Are you echoing on my speakers? Well, I'll get started then. So Ethan asks, I was meditating and a question popped up. If concentrating is impermanent, then why should we cling to it? You see, no matter how often I answer this, I answer this, it keeps coming up, which is indicative of how important the question it is. I mean, it's not exactly this question, but this concept. We're not really trying to concentrate. We're certainly not clinging to concentration. But, I mean, the key here is, this is how we approach meditation. We think meditation is about forcing your mind into some trance state. It can be, meditation can be that. But meditation isn't about concentrating. Not exactly. Meditation is about seeing clearly, or this meditation, the meditation that we practice. So there won't be a clinging to concentration, concentrating. So it's not about stopping your mind from thinking, it's not about keeping your mind in a certain state. It's about learning about the states of mind that arise. Because you can't choose which states to keep and which to discard until you're clear which are good and which are bad. And in fact, once you know what is good and what is bad, the mind will focus on its own. Through wisdom, the mind will focus on what is beneficial and be disinclined towards what is harmful. As far as clinging to meditation is concerned, in the beginning there is definitely some sort of forcing of yourself, forcing the mind to practice, and forcing through walking and through sitting meditation. But it's more just a reforcing, you know, a refocusing of your already rampant ambition. So we're very ambitious already. I want to do this, and so you're just diverting it. In the beginning, you're not actually cultivating something new. You're just refocusing your attention. So instead of going for a run, now maybe I'll just go for a walk. And instead of going for a walk, I'll just stay in my room and I'll walk in my room. So it's just about refocusing your attention, and eventually it becomes just a peaceful way to live. Why not? You know, you've got to do something. Do walking, do sitting, and rather than doing anything, just be mindful. I mean, eventually it doesn't even become about the formal meditation. It's just living your life mindfully, in constant and perfect mindfulness. So there's no clinging, not in the long run for sure, anyway. Robin, are you there? If you are, I can't hear you. Sometimes I can't stay meditating for more than 5 minutes. I feel a pressure in my lungs that looks like I'm going to faint. Anyone know about why that happens? Well, the body does its own things, and you do have to be careful. Sometimes you have to go see a doctor. But it also depends what kind of meditation you're practicing, you know. If you're practicing samatha meditation, strange things can happen. In Vipassana, strange things can happen, but they're generally less severe, and they tend to work themselves out through the practice. So first thing, have you read my booklet on how to meditate? That's the start. If you have, and that's the way you're practicing, then really just try to say feeling. If you're worried about it, say worry. And you should, in most cases, find that it's alleviated, and it becomes reduced. In the beginning, the body is going to react to this new state of mind in relatively extreme ways. I mean, because eventually your body will calm down along with the mind. In the beginning, it'll be relatively extreme, but there will be some fairly strong reactions. You know, sometimes there'll be sickness, sometimes there'll be strong tension, that kind of thing. The body is going to react, and the mind is going to affect the body because of its states that it's going through. We are lucky to have been born as human beings. What about beings in the lower realms? Would they always be born in the lower realms due to their ignorance? Not always. I mean, it's possible for an animal to be reborn as a human being. It's just very difficult, very rare. Because, yeah, they don't have any opportunity to do the sorts of things that incline one to be born as a human being. There's just just a lot of killing and surviving and fighting and sexual intercourse, that's about it, you know, eating. And their lives are very short. Short, nasty, brutish, and short. I don't know. What kind of answer are you looking for? Sounds like you already know the answer. It's very hard for them, but not impossible. Don't think that should be the idea. Is the goal of training the mind in realizing the futility of its getting involved with anything at all, and its involvement is the problem? I just want to clarify my views as they are forming. Well, stop forming views. That's your first problem. You don't have to understand the practice. The understanding will come by itself. You don't have to cultivate some idea of why you're doing what you're doing. If you have doubt about what you're doing, you have to focus on the doubt. Let go of your views. Don't form any new ones. That's the goal. The goal is to let go. So, but maybe being a little bit facetious there, or flippant. The goal is raising the futility. You know, I mean, don't put words into the Buddha's mouth. The goal is to become free from suffering. We should never just reinterpret the Buddha's teaching and say this is the goal or that's the goal. The Buddha gave a clear goal. The goal is freedom from suffering. Now, what that comes through, it comes through letting go. It comes through giving up of desire, the fading away of desire. When there's no more desire, there will be no suffering. How does one give up desire? Well, this is through the Eightfold Noble Paths, which, you know, we tend to focus on mindfulness because the Buddha did. The Buddha was clear that sati was the big one. So the practice is to see things as they are and to remind ourselves and to keep ourselves focused on reality as it is. Eventually that allows you to see impermanent suffering and non-self, see that things are not unpredictable, they're unsatisfying, they're uncontrollable, and that causes you to let go of them. Is Vipassana and Satipatthana meditation the same? Which of the meditations were taught by the Buddha? You know, I had a monk, actually he's a good friend of mine, so be a little bit careful, but he once said to me, and I'm quite sure he said to me, you know, it's funny how memory is, so maybe I'm remembering it wrong, but I've said this several times, is that he once said to me that the word Vipassana isn't in the Tipitaka. Or maybe he didn't quite say it like that. He said Vipassana isn't in the Tipitaka. Maybe he just meant that the practice isn't. And I think I've heard that elsewhere. The Buddha didn't use the word Vipassana. Someone else was saying that it's, you know, it's not a common. The Buddha didn't use the word Vipassana often. It's not like Vipassana was a big thing. Now we make, because they're criticizing our tradition, this tradition, the Goenka tradition, any tradition that talks about something called Vipassana meditation. The Visuddhimagga, basically. In the Visuddhimagga, there's a lot of, well, maybe not even the Visuddhimagga, in the commentaries in general, there's a lot of talk about Vipassana and Samatha. And they say, oh, in the Tipitaka, it wasn't that big of a deal. But that's quite disingenuous, because the Tipitaka is full of talk about Vipassana. It just doesn't use that exact word all the time. It does use that word. The Buddha did talk about Vipassana. And in some very crucial teachings, the teaching about how, which one comes first. So he talks about Samatha and Vipassana going together, about Samatha coming first and then Vipassana, Vipassana and then Samatha. And that's important. That's an important look at, you know, whenever the Buddha talked about meditation, it seems like this kind of concept came up about samatha being tranquility, vipassana being insight, and these two aspects and qualities of meditation as being the salient qualities of meditation practice. So there's that. Now, but more importantly, vipassana means, vipassana means seeing, vi means clearly. So quite, the Buddha used the word seeing throughout the Tipitaka. It's one of the most common sort of metaphors or allegory, or however you say it, that the Buddha would use. Analogy, I guess, is the word. He would say seeing, you see clearly. This idea of seeing clearly. Even when the Buddha talked about, when he described the three characteristics, impermanent, suffering, non-self, he talked about seeing them with wisdom. Panyaya pasati. Pasati, so it's basana, it's the same word. Basana is the noun, pasati is the verb. And vi just means with wisdom. Panyaya is vi, it's the same. So to see with wisdom, to see things for yourself, to see things as they are, yatha bhuta jnana dasana. Dasana is the same word as pasana, it's the same word, it's just there are two forms of the word. Jnana, yatha bhuta jnana dasana. Jnana means knowledge, dasana means vision. So vipassana is throughout the Tipitaka. Vipassana is very much what the Buddha taught. It's just, it's become too much of a buzzword, and that irks some people. I understand that. I do tend to nuance my, I don't use the word vipassana a lot, maybe for that reason, because it has been somewhat, you know, it's become a buzzword. But also because it's important to understand, and this is relating to your, this is now finally answering your question, we don't practice vipassana, we practice satipatthana. And someone, I've said this before, and someone was confused because they went somewhere and they were practicing vipassana, and it's actually our tradition. And they said, well, they're calling it vipassana, so is it not the same thing as you do? Yes, it is. What I'm saying is that you can't practice vipassana. That's not what the practice is. When you say I'm practicing vipassana bhavana, you mean I'm practicing bhavana to gain vipassana, to see clearly. You don't practice seeing clearly. It's not like if I go close enough, I'll see it clearly. You practice what we call sati. So satipatthana is the practice that leads to vipassana. It's a simple, short answer to your question. Satipatthana is what we practice, vipassana is what comes from that practice. So satipatthana means reminding yourself and keeping yourself clearly aware of things as they are, not extrapolating or interpreting them in any way. So there's your answer. Hey Robin, I hear you now.
Oh, okay. Would you like me to read some questions?
Go for it. I wonder if, wait just a second, let's see if you're actually coming through here. Dark eyes, you see, this is... this is the wrong mic. Test. Test. Yes. Oh wait, that's not it. Monitor. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, were you skipping some of the other ones for time purposes, or?
There were other ones?
There were, yes.
Well, maybe, I don't know. Okay, if they're good ones.
Okay. Bhante, here are two related questions. When I die, in other words, this body brain dies, does mind carry over or continue as a sort of individual electrical charge or electrical potential or a sort of electrical impulse carrying information that can inform the minds of subsequent birthed individuals? And if I am in a moment-to-moment process of becoming, Then is the mind that carries into the next moment functionally identical to the mind that carries on beyond physical death of the body and brain?
There's no carrying on. Nothing is ever reborn. Nothing is ever reborn. When something arises, it ceases. Something is finished arising, it ceases. That's it. I can't go beyond that. As far as, it's certainly not an electrical impulse. That's totally misleading. It's a misunderstanding. The mind isn't physical. It has nothing to do, it's not an energy. Mind isn't energy. Although, maybe a different kind of energy, but not in the physics. It's not part of physics. Mind is not a part of physics, let's put it that way. That's what you have to understand. Which is the great thing about quantum physics. If you study early quantum physics, look at the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, what it does is it creates a space for the mind. It says, okay, this is all we can talk about in physics, and this is as far as we go. From here, on this side, we can't even talk about it. It's not the mind side, you see. When we can't talk about the observer, we can't talk about, in fact, ultimate reality. Physics can't talk about ultimate reality. It can only talk about, once you apply your mind to something, you can talk about the results, the physics. And it becomes quite in line with classical physics, classical mechanics. So did I answer everything there? But as far as the mind that is reborn being the same as the mind right now, yes, the rebirth, as birth and death of a being, is just conventional. The reality is the mind arises and ceases. I mean, don't even take my word for it. It's just understand what reality is. Reality is moment to moment. That's what's real. This whole illusion we have, or belief we have in death and rebirth, it's all just conceptual. Where is it? You can't experience it. The experience of death is just experiences of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. What else could it be? I'm not even asking you to believe this. I'm just pointing out. It's the obvious truth. When you die, it's just going to be more experiences. So what is there really but experience? So functionally, it's all the same. No, not even functionally, but in reality, it's all the same. Oh, I see. There's all these questions without question marks. Yeah, well, I was ignoring those ones. If they're not using the question mark, gotta get with the program.
Why is sloth and torpor considered a hindrance, but it's not one of the 10 fetters? While the other four hindrances are fetters as well.
Okay, this is one I just missed, right?
It does have a question mark.
It does. I just skipped it. See, because it jerks, right? I think I missed it.
Yeah, it moves.
It moves. Well, we're getting closer to having our new interface set up, so we'll have to see how that works when we finally get it. So, that's a good question. Sloth and torpor is an interesting one, because on the one hand, you could say it's just a function of, well, to some extent it's a function of the physical, you know, if you're working too hard, or if you're just in general sort of a lazy sort of person, your body will be somewhat slothful. So sloth and torpor, probably these are not really good translations of tina and mita. Tina and mita are sort of a stiffness of mind. They're not fetters because they're more just a product of the fetters. This is my take on it. You know. I don't want to always sound like I have all the answers, and that's dangerous as a teacher to feel like you need to have all the answers. I don't know everything. And this is one example where it's a really good question, one that I've thought about in general terms, but never specifically, never actually made that connection, that it's in the hindrances and not as a fetter. But it is a special one, and that is clear. But it's more a product, you see. Once you give up the other ones, the sloth and torpor will go away as well, because it comes often from greed. You know, you're lazy because you're greedy, because you enjoy lying around, lazing around. Or it can be through delusion, through simply being, why bother, kind of thing. And just sort of arrogance can be very stiffening. Also, and anger as well. I mean, the mind becomes very unwieldy as a result. I think that's probably the proper answer, or it's as close as I get. It's more of a product of the hidden, of unwholesome mind states, rather than being actually an unwholesomeness itself.
Bhante, is the goal training the mind in realizing the futility of its getting involved
this
with anything
I did
at all?
Answer. This one I just answered.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, there's an 8-hour question by Larry that we didn't answer. He's asking us to go back.
That was the one with the electrical charges.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll finish them.
So you did answer that one. I must have been playing with my headset when you answered the one with the 6-hour question. I missed that one.
Oh, I see. 6-hour means the one that's at 6-hour. Oh, that's clever.
Yes.
Okay. And there's Guadalupe is asking about the testimonial page. No, it's not there.
Oh, okay. When making a decision in meditating on the choices and seeing which. Is seeing which calms the mind a good approach?
Yeah, I don't like the whole... I mean, I think it comes to you naturally. I think the best is when you meditate and the decisions you've made come to you and you get a sense that that was not a good decision. That's more how it will come, right? If you did something sort of not with a perfect clear conscience or with a perfect clear mind, yeah. If you're not totally above and above the board, or you're not totally ethical about what you did, you get a sense of that when you meditate. I think that's preferable. This whole consciously trying to get answers, like what is the good thing to do, what is the right decision. I think you're better off just trying to be mindful, not worrying so much about the decisions you make. I think any decision making you, like any decision making you do, is somewhat meta in terms of, you know, outside of the meditation practice. You should be mindful of that decision making and so on. But it should be practical rather than trying to be ethical. You make a decision and, well, maybe that's not quite fair. Being ethical, but more in a mundane sense, like, is this going to hurt me? Is this going to hurt others? Is this proper or improper? Because calming the mind isn't so much in terms of what you do, but it's how you do it, right? But the what you do, you should just reflect. You know, is this to my benefit or the benefit of others, or is this in a mundane sense? Now, I mean, eventually you come to life choices in terms of, if I do this, it's going to cause more complexity in my life, and that will make it harder for me to focus my attention, harder for me to understand the truth, that kind of thing. But I'm not really inclined to focus on this calms my mind and so I should do it. I mean, it sounds fairly specific there, because it's not bad. It's not quite how I would look at things.
Are samadhi and vipassana main meditations? Are all the others like anapanasati, metta, satipatthani part of the samatha and vipassana?
Samatha, not samadhi. Samadhi is a different word. Samadhi is a quality of mind. Samatha means tranquility, vipassana means insight. So certain meditations only lead to tranquility, others lead to insight. And so in Buddhism, yes, any proper meditation we categorize in one or the other, or one or the other, because any that leads to vipassana, it doesn't matter whether it leads to samatha as well. If it leads to vipassana, we call it vipassana. But we call certain meditations samatha, because no matter how much you practice them, they themselves won't lead to insight.
Bhante, aren't sloth and torpor lack of wirya? Wiraya?
No. I mean, yeah. That doesn't contradict what I said about them not being technically fetters or defilements. They are still based on, what does it mean to lack wirya? You're basically saying the same thing. To have low energy is to not have energy. I guess stiffness is the technical term, but you're stiff because of lack of energy. But the question is why? Why is there that imbalance? And the imbalance comes from the defilement, I would say.
What does faith mean in terms of Buddhism? How is one a faithful Buddhist? In Christianity, you have to believe in God and heaven, etc. What is faith for a Buddhist?
I've gone over this. I did go over this earlier, and I went over it today a little bit. But didn't I just answer that? We're talking about sadho. Someone should have faith, but based on reason. I ask you to go and listen to what I already said. Faith is based on examination, investigation. So in a preliminary level, you base it on your mundane investigation. So you investigate a teacher, you investigate a teaching, and you think about it, and it sort of makes sense. But then true faith comes from practice. Once you put the teachings into practice, you're able to see that they benefit you. But what I wanted to say is that it's important not to just cling to doubt and say, okay, I'm always going to be, if I don't doubt things, then I might fall into faith. And faith is a good thing, but it's only really a good thing if the object of the faith is worth having faith in. But once something is worth having faith in, there are things that it is worth having faith in. But true faith, it can't come from just believing blindly. True faith has to come through, and it's not actually faith then, but the word is belief or confidence. Comes from seeing things as true, from seeing things for yourself. Then you have perfect confidence in them. All right, it's after 10 o'clock. That's enough for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Have a good night. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Bhante. Thank you, Bhante. Yeah.